Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Margot Singer, award-winning author of the novel Underground Fugue. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our new Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwall and Danielle Levy. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Today we begin the Jewish calendar month of Elul, last month of the year. We begin to prepare ourselves for the coming Jewish Days of Awe, the High Holy Days, exactly 4 weeks from now, with Rosh Hashanah, beginning Sunday night, September 29th. The word Elul, the name of this Hebrew month, is made up of four letters, Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed. In a beautiful interpretation, these letters stand for the beginnings of the words, Ani ledodi vedodi li. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. A passage from the biblical book, the Song of Songs, which teaches us that at this time of year, God wants to unify with us, to renew the bonds of love and tenderness that come from this period of return and renewal. To remind us that tshuva, repentance and return, are more than a two-day-a-year process, we Jews sound the shofar each day of this month of Elul, awakening us to the need to reform and return to the best that we can be, to apologize to those we've wronged or injured. Blowing a shofar is a great way to wake people up. A shofar is a ram's horn, of course, hollowed out. You can actually make a real horn shofar of your own if you want, and with a bit of practice, you too can learn to blow shofar. Our school children at our congregation Beit Simcha Religious School all learn how to do it. So can you. It's a great way to experience the urgency of the coming High Holy Days. An ancient, haunting sound, nonetheless oddly beautiful and dramatic. I happened to bring a shofar along this morning to kind of blow us in to this Two Jewish show on the first day of Elul. It goes like this. Well, if you weren't awake yet this morning, you surely are now. To play us in this morning in a little bit more elegant way, on the same theme of the shofar, we begin with a setting of the classic Rosh Hashanah text, Tka b'shofar, sound the great shofar of freedom, proclaiming liberty and gathering exiles from the four corners of the earth to return, perhaps even to return to our synagogue for services on Rosh Hashanah in 4 weeks.
Tka. Tka b'shofar gadol lechirutenu, mesales, mesales lekabez galuyotenu, bekamtenu yahad mehera, mehera, me'ad makan kotaretz le'atzenu.
Tka. Shofar gadol lechirutenu, v'sa, v'sanes, v'sanes lekabet galuyotenu, v'kabetzeinu yachad mehera, mehera,
me'ar batan fotaret le'atzeinu. Tka.
Come.
Shabbat Seinu Yachad Mehera Mehera
Me'ar Batan Fotar Et Me'ar Seinu
Seinu yachad mehera mehera me'ar batan chotares le'artzeinu.
Tika b'shofar, for the coming High Holy Days, the season of the shofar. It's also Labor Day weekend, and during a busy time of year, this marks the only real pause in a fall that is full of activity. Since rabbis and cantors work overtime preparing for the coming High Holy Days, it's wonderful to have a celebration of labor this weekend and a day off. So while you prepare for barbecues, concerts, and such, and enjoy the last real work day off before Thanksgiving, here's a bit about this holiday that has special meaning for Jews. Long before it became an excuse for a three-day weekend, Labor Day was a significant statement about the value of a human being's hard work. When it started, the very concept that labor even had value, morally and economically, was controversial. In America, Labor Day was created back in the 1880s as a way to celebrate and support the working man and working woman. It was a way to demonstrate that labor mattered, that capital wasn't the only value in the economy or society. But many great Americans understood this from their own personal experiences already. Abraham Lincoln said, "Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor, and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration." We Jews have always believed that labor has moral quality. A great statement in Pirkei Avot, the Mishnah tractate, the ethics of our ancestors, says, "Al shlosha devarim ha'olam omeid al ha'torah ve'al ha'avodah ve'al gemilut chasadim." The world is based on three things: on Torah, on labor, and on acts of selfless kindness. The Hebrew word avodah, labor, primarily means practical, prosaic work as we know it, although it also implies divine service. The connection of labor to service to God is intentional. For Jews, honest work is an important form of prayer. This exaltation of basic labor as a foundation of society, and even as a way to serve God, is very Jewish. You might not know that until quite recently, being a rabbi wasn't a paying profession. Most of the great rabbis and scholars in Jewish history had day jobs to make a living. From Rabbi Yochanan HaSandlar, a sandal or shoemaker in the days of the Talmud, to Maimonides, the 12th century physician in Spain, to the rabbis of Eastern Europe who made a living in the lumber trade or working as butchers. For Jews, not only has there never been any shame in hard work, there's been a kind of exaltation of it. It should come as no surprise that many of the great organizers of labor in history, really throughout history, have been Jews, and that a movement based on exalting work, the labor Zionists, settled and created the State of Israel and formed much of its culture. In America, important names in labor, from Samuel Gompers to Emma Goldman, were Jewish. Gompers, the founder and longtime president of the American Federation of Labor, perhaps the single most important figure for 40 years in the labor movement in America, was a guiding force in the development of the labor movement, but also of Labor Day itself. Samuel Gompers said, "Labor Day differs in every essential way from the other holidays of the year in any other country. All other holidays are in a more or less degree connected with conflicts and battles of man's prowess over man, of strife and discord for greed and power, of glories achieved by one nation over another. Labor Day is devoted to no man, living or dead, to no sect, race, or nation. It celebrates all of our work, our avodah, our service, in a meaningful way. So, as you enjoy Too Jewish today, enjoy the day off of labor tomorrow. But remember, it is the workers who built our country and support our society. Those who do the hard work deserve respect and honor and must be treated as equals. Our guest this morning, author Margot Singer, has written a beautiful and complex book, Underground Fugue, that combines Judaism, terrorism, England, the Holocaust, music, the subways, and much more, and it does so with elegance and care. Meet Margot Singer when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning, Margot Singer, the author of the award-winning novel Underground Fugue, winner of the Edward Lewis Wallant Award, finalist for the Sammy Rohrer Prize for Jewish Fiction. She's also written the short story collection The Pale of Settlement, a much awarded and interesting writer. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Tell us a little bit about the inspiration for Underground Fugue.
The inspiration for any novel is hard to trace, but I would say that it comes from what NPR likes to call a driveway moment. I was sitting in my car, in my driveway, back in the spring of 2005, and a piece ran on public radio about an incident that had taken place in the south of England on the coast. A strange man had washed up more or less on the beach. The police found him wandering along the road barefoot, wearing a formal black suit and tie, and they brought him into the police station. He didn't seem to be able to speak, and he had no identification. The labels had been cut out of his clothes. He had no wallet or ID. And so this sparked a kind of international buzz when a report was put out on the missing persons helpline, and people started calling in from all over the world, speculating as to who he might be. For a long time, none of them was right. Eventually, at the end of the summer, his identity was revealed. It turned out that he could speak. But at the time, it was a sort of romantic mystery of who could this character be. And for some reason, the image of that man, the British tabloids quickly dubbed him the Piano Man because he played the piano quite well, even though he seemed to either have amnesia or be unable to speak or remember who he was. So I just was struck by that image, and I don't think I even knew really why I was struck by it at the time. My first thought was, oh, this would be a cool topic for a novel, and then my second thought was, you can't really write a novel about a character who doesn't talk. But he did end up in the novel. The prologue is sort of the image of this character, and then one of my other characters, who's a neurologist, actually does go in to examine him at one point in the book, and that story is sort of in the background, and I think informs the book in terms of its themes of memory and loss and migration in certain ways.
So a brief question, do you play the piano?
I do.
I just kind of suspected so in reading the book. You know, fugue, of course, an important form, and excuse me, as you mentioned, it plays an important part of the novel. We will talk much more with Margot Singer when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, is celebrating services, classes, events, and its very first High Holy Days this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Congregation Beit Simcha is creating a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson of the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us this Friday night at 7315 North Oracle Road for Shabbat evening services at 6:30 p.m. with a Tot Kabbalat Shabbat beforehand at 5:30 p.m. for families of young children, and Saturday morning Torah study at 9 o'clock, followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Join us this Shabbat at 7315 North Oracle Road, Beit Simcha, on the west side of Oracle, just north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, High School programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, go to www.BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and the fastest-growing synagogue at its exciting beginning year and first high holidays. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2jewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website, 2jewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, there are Jewish communities spread all over the world, and there's a stereotype where you have two Jews, three opinions, four synagogues.
Right.
Or the famous story about the guy on the desert island alone who builds two synagogues, one that he goes to and the other one he wouldn't be caught dead in. Right. We have this stereotype that all Jewish communities are fractious, and there's some truth to that, of course. But I've found, and I know you've found, in smaller communities where there aren't so many Jews, people have to get along, and they find a way to do it and create quite diverse, interesting Jewish synagogues and congregations and communities.
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. I mean, I'll give you two personal experiences from the last several months.
Right?
really radically different experiences. In May, as you may remember, I led a group to three cities in Morocco and three cities in Andalusia.
I think our listeners may remember as well.
Right. The part of Spain that once was really a great center of Jewish life and culture.
The golden age of Spain. Of
right.
Jewish Spain.
So there, effectively, Cordoba, which was the capital of Sfarad, and Granada no longer have organized Jewish communities and no longer have numbers of people. They each have a Jewish museum that's like privately run, not necessarily by Jews, but no synagogue, no functioning community activities. There are places in Spain that do have that.
Yeah, of course. Madrid certainly does. Barcelona, there's
a lot of places.
Right.
Not necessarily in continuous operation since the time of the Inquisition,
no,
but nonetheless in operation. Now, the really interesting case that goes against your opening proposition was Sevilla, where it's a big city,
beautiful
big
city.
International airport, lots of Jewish history, and effectively two Jewish communities that might as well be on separate planets. They don't interact at all. There is, for example, a Jewish museum which is very well done, run by a woman who immigrated fairly recently from Venezuela, and she belongs to the liberal Jewish community. And there is a guy, a doctor, who also recently immigrated from Venezuela, who belongs to the traditional or Orthodox Jewish community. The two of them never even heard of each other, in spite of the fact that it's a relatively small community and in relative isolation. When my group went for Saturday morning services to the Orthodox synagogue, it was the first time in months that they had had a minyan, and they were very excited because they could do Torah reading and all that. It's a very Orthodox, very traditional group of people. Friday night, part of my group went to the progressive community, which is in a very hip part of town, much bigger and livelier. They have a school. They have something called Makom Sfarad. They have same-sex couples. They have mixed marriages. Everybody's welcome. And it is interesting to me that even in a place as small and as threatened by extinction repeatedly over the centuries as Sevilla, that these two Jewish communities have virtually no interaction at all. Now, the second example, I guess we'll deal with next week, is a much more recent one, and it's in our own country.
Fascinating. You're right. I mean, certainly we do have that capacity, but it'll be, I think, look forward to being able to talk about ways in which we see communities that do come together in these ways. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The rabbi was in the middle of his sermon when he beckoned to the shamus, the head usher, to come over. The rabbi said to him, "That man in the third row is asleep. Wake him up." The shamus replied, "You put him to sleep. You wake him up." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, representing the Weintraub Center here in America, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So you guys lived in areas that were just like Tucson, right? Giant saguaro cacti everywhere, and maybe not
absolutely
so much. Huh?
No, so in Israel Valley, I used to have cows in my backyard. We have those huge wild pigs.
Pigs,
I
yeah.
Say.
Yeah. Wild pigs. Mm-hmm. We don't think about Israel as a producer of pigs.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Not yeah. Kosher.
Yes, right, exactly. Absolutely. We have nonstop cats running around. So, this is actually a big difference for me.
Yeah, yes, so you were used to like really farm country. It's very,
exactly.
It's still
mm-hmm.
very rich farmland. They still
yes.
produce. You know, we think about Israel as like high tech and startup nation, but of course it started with the resettlement of the mm-hmm. land, and the Zionist enterprise was to create an agricultural place, and
exactly.
Emek Israel's, you know, still mm-hmm. sort of ideal of what it was like.
Yes, it is.
Shai, tell us, like, you know, you didn't get up in the morning and see cacti either in Ramat Gan so much.
Yeah, let me tell you a story. So the Negev area in Israel, it's like it's beautiful desert. You have sand and sand and a little bit much more than sand. And
yep.
here you have a desert with completely, you know, green, olive green and cactuses, so it's really, really nice comparing to Israel desert. But when I woke up in the morning, I live at a small neighborhood in Ramat Gan, so I also saw all the time meet with my friends. I see them, they're close to me, my high school, we all like in a little bubble. Yeah.
It so a
little bubble in a big city area, really.
Yeah.
Because actually, Emek Israel is a bubble.
Yeah, Emek Israel
honest.
Is
yeah.
a bubble,
absolutely.
Too. It's like
yeah.
a rural bubble, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I would say of this, every time it's, we've now had several groups of Shin Shinim, Shin Shiniyot, who are here, and everybody kind of talks about growing up in a bubble. And mm-hmm. it's, I think, more true for you guys. Now, Danielle, you lived in other countries,
I
right?
Did.
So to have that bubble mm-hmm. Is very interesting because you would think that you would have the perspective that, okay, this isn't real, but it is real, isn't it?
It is. I think, like at first when I moved to, because in Finland I was really small, I can't really remember anything, but I remember like coming to Israel and just to Germany, just like being able to go to school alone by myself, a little girl, with, it's called an U-Bahn, it's like subway. And everything just is so big. And so it was absolutely like popping the bubble for me, because Israel Valley, like without my parents, I can't get anywhere. We need a car to just get to the supermarket or just like to the center, like some sort of center that we have. So it was just like a big change for me, like seeing the out world and just to see that there's so much more like outside of this small moshav that I live in. So that was the biggest experience
big
for
difference.
Me. Yeah.
And Shai, you know, you probably knew everybody in your neighborhood, right?
Yeah, I actually did. Still.
You still know everybody.
Yeah, I still know everybody. Yeah, so it's a very big difference from here. You know, when we landed here, so both of us were on the plane. And then from the plane, we saw like a little, very, very small city.
Yeah.
And then when we when we got on the car, so it was like half an hour driving. So
it's not such a small city.
Yeah.
You know, I do think when you grow up in Israel, it's a small country, right?
It is.
Physically small. A lot of people, 7-8 million people, but just not physically big. You can go from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv in an hour with traffic, 2 hours. You know, you can go from Haifa to Caesarea. Like, it's not far. Like, anything is pretty close.
You get in 8 hours from the north side to the south side, and you cross the whole
from
country.
From Eilat to, I don't know, to Akko. It's really not that far.
It is. Yeah.
But here, of course, that'll be a different experience for you guys. Mm-hmm. And getting a sense of the space, it's a different space. Well, I think you'll like it, and I think you'll also really enjoy going back to Israel. Thanks. We will talk next week.
Thank you so much.
And now a word of Torah. This week's portion from Deuteronomy is called Shoftim, Judges. It establishes a process for the administration of justice, and it includes one of the most powerful statements in all religious, philosophical, or ethical tradition. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Justice, justice you shall pursue. In the Torah, which has no kefel lashon, no extra words, a repetition of a word means that it has additional importance and power. Here, the word for justice, tzedek, is repeated, emphasizing that justice is extraordinarily significant. We must be not only fair in life, but truly just. We must find a way to remove our own ego needs in any judging situation and seek not self-justification, but true justice. Sometimes we must even admit that our processes of justice can result in unjust decisions and unfair punishment. That, too, is part of seeking true justice. But even more than that, the Torah teaches that we must not only be just, but tirdof, pursue justice, chase it, make it a goal for our own lives and our civilization. It's not enough to act well in a place where justice is not the norm. We must strive to change that unjust situation into a just one. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Each of us must pursue true justice. You know, it's easy to understand that for Jews, justice underlies everything good in a society. Without justice, there is no peace. Without justice, there is no morality. Without justice, we simply can't trust our leaders or our government to act well. Sometimes we need to be forcibly reminded that on many issues, injustice still remains. We must continue to work seriously to rectify this, and so to pursue justice. Be just, God commands. Never accept injustice as a permanent condition of life. Chase justice in your own life. Strive for justice in your organizations and institutions. Work for justice in your society. Then good can follow. It's a great and holy message in a society like ours, in which the pursuit of happiness sometimes seems to be the only goal. But the better pursuit than happiness, indeed the most meaningful real pursuit for us, is justice. May our actions and our words help make our society more just in this week and in the coming year of 5780, just 4 weeks away. Our guest this morning, Margot Singer, is an elegant writer, and her book is filled with Jewish themes of memory, hiding, and discovery. Discover how and why she wrote Underground Fugue. We'll return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Bill Maher, HBO's late-night political satirist, is not backing down after he dove last week into the debate surrounding the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, Israel, and the U.S.'s first two female Muslim congresswomen, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. Maher, in his Friday night show, slammed the BDS movement, I think quite correctly, as ridiculous, wrong-headed, and discriminatory. His comments led to Tlaib suggesting boycotting Maher's show. Maybe folks should boycott his show. I'm tired of folks discrediting a form of speech centered on equality and freedom. This is how they tried to discredit and stop the boycott and stand up against the apartheid in South Africa. It didn't work then, won't work now, Tlaib tweeted. The back and forth kicked off when Maher declared the BDS movement is a BS purity test by people who want to appear woke, but actually slept through history class. It's predicated on this notion, I think very shallow thinking, that the Jews in Israel are mostly white and the Palestinians are browner, so they must be innocent and correct and the Jews must be wrong. As if the occupation came right out of the blue that this completely peaceful people found themselves occupied, Maher said. Some people have one move only, boycott, cancel, make go away. But here's the thing. The House of Representatives voted 318-17 to condemn the BDS movement, including 93% of Democrats. Does Tlaib want to boycott 93% of her own party? Maher also highlighted past comments from Omar, saying he understands why Israel doesn't give them a warm welcome. Congresswoman Omar has said things like, "It's all about the Benjamins. Israel has hypnotized the world. May Allah awaken the people and help them see the evil doings of Israel," Maher noted. She apologized for it, but it's out there. Jews control the world, control the money, Maher noted, but added, "I can see why they don't get a hero's welcome." Tlaib rejected an offer by Israel to let her travel to the West Bank, the latest twist in the dispute, drawing Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu together against U.S. Democrats ahead of elections in both countries. In other news, Amazon announced the launch of operations in Israel. The company set up a website in Hebrew which talks about its local delivery services in order to attract vendors. Amazon also is asking overseas businesses to warehouse their inventory in Israel and make arrangements with international shippers to deliver their products through local shippers. "We are currently working with sellers in Israel to help them sell worldwide with Amazon Global Selling," Amazon said in a statement. "Local delivery is one aspect of global selling that looks to improve the opportunities for sellers in Israel to sell more effectively to customers in Israel who shop on Amazon." And our department of the More Things Change, More They Stay the Same reports that famed Jewish television and radio talk show host Larry King, who is famous for saying, "I never learned anything while I was talking," apparently also never learned much while getting divorced, because he is now ending his marriage to his seventh wife, Sean, after 22 years. The 85-year-old King, who has a show on the Russia Today and Hulu networks, but is most famous for his CNN Larry King Live that ran from 1985 to 2010. Larry King filed for divorce from Sean King, who's 59 years old, once before back in 2010 after she allegedly had an affair, but he later retracted the paperwork. Larry King also reported that he considered divorcing Sean, with whom he has two adult sons, back in 2016, when he learned that Sean, a singer and former TV personality, was having a long-term romance with another man. Well, apparently they have now reached the end of the line. Larry King got married for the first time in 1952. He has been married 8 times altogether to 7 women since he married and divorced Aline Atkins twice. Sean King boasted to the Daily News back in 2008 that she was the only wife to have lasted into the 2 digits. Well, she made it past 20, but I guess it's done now. And that's the 2 Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to 2 Jewish, our guest this morning, Margot Singer, the author of the much-awarded novel Underground Fugue, a series of other excellent works, although series isn't quite right because, both novels and short stories take their own time, don't they? A Pale of Settlement came out, I guess, about 10 years before Underground Fugue. Tell us a little bit about your writing process, if you don't mind.
Well, my writing life has been constrained to some extent, as it is for most writers, by the need to
make
have
a living,
life,
be a college professor, stuff like that.
Yeah, I teach college. Before that, I had a very different career. I worked in business. I was a management consultant for about a decade, and then went back and got a degree in creative writing and had some kids along the way. So I'm a pretty slow writer, but I've also been really busy doing all the other things one does. But I think that I have a couple of colleagues who are poets, and the more time I spend with them, the more I have come to think that I write kind of like a poet, which is a rather slow way to write for a novelist. I really get interested in language and hung up at the sentence level and sort of turning sentences around in my head. And I like to have a firm base to build on. This novel, I thought, I was just the only person writing hundreds of pages of drafts and kind of throwing them away and starting over. But it turns out that most novelists seem to go through this awful process. So I'm not sure that I'm alone in that. But I'm pretty slow and pretty meticulous. But one way or another, it gets done. I wasn't sure that I was a novelist. I love writing short stories. I had written mostly short stories until I started this project. But now I find myself kind of used to and drawn into the longer narrative forms.
I've seen it attributed to everyone from sports writers to Ernest Hemingway, but that line, it's very easy to write, you just sit at a typewriter until blood comes out of your forehead.
Right.
It's always a challenge to write well. The title and the whole story are kind of, filled with double and triple meanings. Underground, of course, the London Underground plays a crucial role in the story. There's secrets. Everyone has secrets in your book, don't they?
Yes.
Tell us, I don't want to do any, I don't want any spoiler alerts here, but in the course of creating that, how do you keep track of all of the backstories?
What took me the longest in terms of the process of writing was finding a form, and I got really interested in musical forms, maybe just because they offer a kind of more obvious structure than mere chronology. I played the piano. Ironically enough, I really didn't like playing Bach very much. Bach was sort of, you have to be meticulous and practice slowly and evenly, and I'm not very patient. So Bach was really hard for me. But I got very interested
So you're a novelist who writes like a poet and plays piano, and you're not very patient.
I know, right? It seems to be a paradox, but it's the case. I found that I got interested in the form of the musical fugue, which is a type of music that was popular early in Bach's life. It was actually falling out of favor by the time he was old and wrote his masterpiece that is called The Art of Fugue, that showcases every possible thing you can do with the fugue. A fugue is basically a round, and it gets as complicated as 5 or 6 different voices all playing simultaneously in harmony. And so it lends itself to a narrative in multiple voices. And so this novel is narrated from 4 perspectives of the characters. And I wrote the novel alternating from one to the next. It felt like, almost like a relay where one runner hands off the baton to the next runner. So So I didn't really keep track of all the narrative threads in any sense of outlining the whole thing, but rather just kind of stayed with the characters from moment to moment and let them kind of play out one at a time. In the beginning, I found myself just tracing patterns. As you said, the underground imagery, sort of the way in which characters were either running from or chasing after different things, those kinds of themes kind of emerged in the process of writing.
Which is sort of what happens in a fugue. You know, each kind of line chases, and then it's chased by other lines, musically speaking.
That's right. The word fugue actually comes from the Latin word, which means to chase. The word refugee comes from the same root, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, both the musical fugue and the sort of and the psychiatric fugue, the fugue state that my Piano Man character seemed to be suffering from, where you kind of lose all sense of who you are and end up many, many miles away from home.
Right, from all of the spinning lines whirling around you, sort of.
Right. Right, those two meanings seemed most relevant.
Do you consider yourself a Jewish writer?
I do. I think my it's easier to see that perhaps in the first book, which is a collection of stories set mostly in Israel. My father grew up in Israel, and most of my family lives there, so that connection seems to come up again and again in my work. I'm currently working on a project set in Israel and in Palestine in the 1800s. So yeah, I do. This book, it's set in London in 2005, and only a few of the characters are Jewish, but I feel like their issues and struggles and memories and themes were the core of the project from the start.
And some of that refugee quality also, of course, is woven into the story.
Right. I think it's a story very much about migration and what it means to be displaced and what it means to be in a situation today and how, you know, post 9/11 questions of migration echo with what the Jewish community experienced, you know, in World War II in particular.
Terrorism plays a big part in your book, without giving anything away, I hope. With an Israeli background, how hard is it to write about terrorism? How is it to relate it to all of the stuff that's gone on to a much greater degree in a place like England than in America?
I have like 10 thoughts.
We'll take them one at a time, then.
Yeah, I grew up going to Israel often. We went most summers to visit my grandparents and my cousins. And I remember family members and friends and kids at school saying, "What? You're going to Israel? Isn't it dangerous? How can you, you know, go there?" And I have to say that it never seemed dangerous to me at all. I have one memory of being very young. I must have been 5 or 6 and bending down to pick up, I think, an empty plastic jug on the street and like freaking out. And I didn't understand what was wrong.
Like, yeah, what's
wrong with a plastic piece of trash?
Right.
Other than that memory, we hung out at the beach and we went to my grandparents' house and Cape's, and it was a very comfortable, safe place. It never, you know, I lived there in the summer of 1982 during the invasion of Lebanon. It wasn't worried about terrorism at all, and I've never experienced directly. The novel ended up being set in 2005 partly because of the Piano Man story happening to be during that summer, but also because I think that I was still really grappling with what 9/11 meant at the time that I was writing the book, as many of us were. I had been living in New York for 10 years, but I'd moved away by the time, by 2001. I was living out west in Utah. And so, again, I felt very removed from the reality of it. But it's a very real presence that is sort of there threatening us, and I wanted to explore what that meant.
Do you think the sort of changing canvas of responses to refugees, both here and in Europe, influenced the work that you did?
on this book?
I think it did. I mean, as you said up front, the book took a long time to write, and the world continues to change around you. It's funny, I started the first notes around 2005 and even thought, oh, I'm probably a little too close to the time frame to be able to write about it, and then really did most of the work on the book between 2011 and 2014, so much later. And I think that by the time I was really in the thick of it, refugee issues were far more prominently in the news than they had been when I started. So it sort of came into its own in terms of resonance with those kinds of questions.
The you know, writing a novel, sort of like giving birth to a child, right? It's just a lot. takes more time, but maybe not quite as painful in the immediate part. In the process of creating Underground Fugue, were you thinking, gosh, I need to do this again? I never want to do this again? You know, others come from so many different perspectives.
Yes, all of the above. I for a long time said I'm never going to do this again. All I wanted to do was go away and write some short stories. But I have to tell you that I finished the novel and the first thing I sat down and started working on was another novel. But, you know, I never know what anything's going to be when I'm working on it. I have an idea. It's like stepping stones that are very far apart, and sometimes they turn out not to be what I thought. So who knows is the short answer. But I have found myself, you know, more trusting of the process, more interested in what can happen when you dive more deeply into a set of themes. Even my story collection ended up being linked stories, where it was more interesting to me to follow the same characters through multiple episodes than to start, you know, reimagining characters from scratch each time.
Kind of a novel from through stories initially.
That's right.
There's a relationship, a very interesting relationship that kind of forms the core of the book. Is this a reflection of anything in your own life?
The book, it really is not autobiographical. I'm happy to say, and this is not spoiling anything since you learned this in the first few pages, but I am happily married. I have two children who are alive and well. My mother's alive and well. So the major dramatic elements of the book are not taken from my own life. But I think they're real things that affect many of us, and inevitably at some point, I suppose we all lose a parent, and I wanted to feel what that meant. So not autobiographical, but very real.
Who influenced your writing style, do you think? What authors have you taken from, and who has inspired you?
I always struggle with that question because the answer tends to be whoever I have loved the most in the last 3 months. I'm very fickle. I love the great prose stylists, but I find them in so many, many forms. I just finished rereading Penelope Lively's Moon Tiger. I don't know if you know that novel. From about 25 years ago, and she's wonderful. So again, just because I've been reading that, I just finished reading also on my night table Elizabeth Hardwick's Sleepless Nights. And, you know, I just finished reading George Saunders' Lincoln and the Bardo, which is a more recent book. So, again, it's whatever I've most recently read that I just didn't want to end and loved.
So a funny observation about Underground Fugue, it, when you started, it begins to feel like a Robert Ludlum novel, you know, like that there's a mystery. You want to know what's going to happen. It then evolves into something quite literary and beautiful, but were you worried about that, aware of that at the start?
I was mostly worried that I wouldn't be able to do the plot part of it, like a lot of literary writers who are interested in language and, you know, the plot part, the plot element seems daunting. But I think, again, you have to trust the process and follow the characters and their stories. And that's all that I did. So I'm glad to hear that. I wasn't sure. Thanks for confirming.
Sure. I can see the movie version of this coming. You know.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
It's funny.
I read an article in the British newspaper, The Guardian, not long ago about a couple of teenage boys arrested for exploring the tunnels in the underground. And I thought, Oh, no. I thought I made that up.
You apparently did not.
Apparently, I did not.
Apparently, this is real.
I want to thank Margot Singer for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Underground Fugue. Where can people go to find out more about you, about the book, about your work?
It's available in all the normal places. I encourage you to go to your local independent bookstore.
Go find your local independent bookstore first, but then go there, right?
But it's on Amazon and IndieBound and where books are sold.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be the very prominent Orthodox Rabbi Avi Weiss, founder of Open Orthodoxy, author of the new book on that process called The Journey to Open Orthodoxy. Our playout this morning comes from a great klezmer band, the Chicago Klezmer Ensemble, and their album Sweet Home Bukovina. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.